I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's time for our Friday features, and in Faith Matters, we decided, in honor of our fifth anniversary on the air, to ask five faith leaders from around the country to offer some words of encouragement. That's later in the program. But first to what has become one of our signature segments over the past 5 years, the barbershop. That's where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Normally, we conclude every Friday show with a shop visit, but today we decided to start the show with the guys, since we have a special visitor in our Washington, D.C. studio. The former Attorney General of the United States, Alberto Gonzalez, is with us. He served during the administration of George W. Bush. He's also a former White House counsel and a former judge. Judge Gonzalez, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
It's good to be back in Washington.
Also here in Washington, D.C. with us, freelance journalist Jimmy Israel and civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar. And from Austin, Mario Loyola of the National Review Magazine and the Texas Public Policy Foundation. That's a conservative think tank that looks at the role of federal policies on the states, among other things. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas, welcome to the shop. How are we doing?
Hey.
Great to be with you.
We're good.
Judge Alberto Gonzalez, thanks so much for coming in. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much.
All right, well, let's get things started. This Saturday, the court is in session. Now, I'm talking about the Military Tribunal Court in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Now, at the center of the trial, the big bad KSM, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He is the self-proclaimed mastermind of numerous terrorist attacks, including 9/11 and the murder of American journalist Daniel Pearl.
You know, in fact, this is the second time Khalid Sheikh Mohammed will be arraigned. The Obama administration unsuccessfully attempted to move the case to federal court in New York in 2009. But tomorrow, he and four other alleged terrorists were going to face trial for crimes that carry the death penalty if they're convicted, Jimmy.
Thanks for that, Michelle. There's a lot of debate about whether military tribunals can deliver justice. Also, part of the criticism is that KSM was waterboarded and subjected to other questionable interrogation methods. So some people argue that the case has been tainted from the get-go. Judge Alberto Gonzalez, will there always be questions about whether this trial is fair?
Well, thank you for starting me off on a very easy topic.
Welcome to the barbershop.
Listen, I think that the government has worked extremely hard to put in place a system that is fair. It's a system that the Congress and the President of the United States have signed off on in terms of being fair. And I think that at the end of the day, once these things start rolling, that people will get more comfortable with military commissions and will understand that they are, in fact, a legitimate means to bring people to justice.
Okay. Mario Loyola, Super Mario, you worked on detainee policy during the Bush administration. When you were at the Pentagon, what do you think?
Well, the problem that we're facing is that this is a new kind of war. We have a scheme that gives privileges to prisoners of war, and then we have a different scheme that gives privileges to defendants in a criminal justice context. But because the terrorists, like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, are both criminals and combatants, they're in a position to accumulate the privileges of both. It is absolutely perverse, for example, in my opinion, to send Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to civilian court in New York while trying the coal bombers in a military commission. And, you know, the Attorney General Holder's explanation of this a couple of years back, that it's because, well, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed attacked civilians, therefore he should be in civilian court, and the coal bombers attacked a military target, therefore they should be in a military court, you know, is unbelievable. That's a shocking explanation, because what that's doing is setting up a huge incentive for terrorists to attack civilians instead of military targets.
Awesome.
Well, as the only lefty lawyer here on the barbershop, I'm going to have to respectfully disagree with my colleagues here. I think there are many, many things in place here. I think, first of all, we have to understand that Attorney General Eric Holder has said that we in the United States have successfully prosecuted over 300 terrorism suspects in our Article III civilian courts, including the 1993 World Trade Center bombers, obviously Timothy McVeigh, the people who attacked the U.S. embassies in Africa in 1998. And so to think that we do not have the legal justice system in place here, I think, is a political red herring. And, you know, as you mentioned, Michelle, President Obama tried to move the trial of KSM to Manhattan in 2009, and essentially the Republican majority in Congress passed legislation that would block any funding for him to allow to do that.
Just to clarify, the president wasn't bowing to political reality. He was bowing to legislative reality, which is that the Congress cut off the funding and said that you just can't do it. And I just want to play, just to remind people that this was a priority of the administration. Here's a clip of President Obama talking about this. This is one of the first orders he issued when he took office.
In order to effect the appropriate disposition of individuals currently detained by the Department of Defense at Guantanamo, and promptly to close the detention facility at Guantanamo consistent with the national security and foreign policy interests of the United States and the interests of justice, I hereby order.
Arsene, just what about the original question on the table, though, was will this trial have legitimacy?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Can I jump in for a second?
Briefly.
I want to respond to something. You know, the trials of the criminal trials of the, for example, the World Trade Center bombers in the 1990s were not successful because, among other things, information came out and was released to the public in those trials that told Osama bin Laden something he didn't know, which is that we, our intelligence services, understood the hierarchy of al-Qaeda and understood what its top leadership was and that we were tracking them on cell phones. So they stopped using cell phones. And that put the nation in very grave danger.
So the question, Mario, is do you feel that this procedure will have legitimacy?
Of course. I mean, it's a procedure of very long standing. We've had it since the very beginning of the Republic. And all countries, all developed nations have a system for military justice and for the treatment of war crimes. I mean, these people commit their crimes notoriously. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed laughs about having killed 3,000 people. This is not a situation in which you have a criminal defendant that we have to protect from the state because he might be innocent.
Judge Gonzalez, I want to give you a kind of a final word here. So you remember very well the argument of whether Guantanamo should be open, should it stay open. It's now open. Do you think that there's still a need for it? I mean,
yes.
Will we 5 years from now, will we still be having this conversation?
I can't predict that. But Guantanamo was established because there was a need, a place to put dangerous terrorists captured in the war on terror. That need continues today. That's the only reason Guantanamo exists today. And as to whether or not it'll continue to exist 5 years from now, that remains to be seen. Hopefully not. You know, President Bush didn't want Guantanamo to continue. He wanted it closed as quickly as possible, but it remained open because of the need.
I think most people forget that President Bush did not want it to remain
open. He also was very, very I can't tell you the number of times I'd walk into the Oval Office and he would ask me, when are we going to begin military commissions? He was very frustrated by virtue of the fact that we could not stand these up because he did want to bring them to justice. He felt they would be good. And it's been a long time coming, but I'm glad seeing these commissions stood up.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're having our weekly barbershop roundtable. We're joined this week by the former Attorney General of the United States, Alberto Gonzalez. Also with us, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, columnist Mario Loyola, and freelance journalist Jimmy Israel. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Okay, well, we're moving to presidential politics and the ruffling of some feathers in Mitt Romney's campaign. Foreign policy advisor Richard Grenell resigned from the GOP candidates team less than a month after he was hired.
Now, I'm puzzled by this because the reporting says that he was pushed out by culturally conservative Republicans because he's an openly gay man, and Mr. Romney's team denies that accusation. But then there are, some 800 Twitter posts that he did delete where he makes comments about Newt Gingrich's weight, Calista Gingrich's hair, journalist Rachel Maddow's looks. I'm just sort of puzzled by this.
I'm not so puzzled.
Okay.
Just
FYI. I guess I'm just saying, do you get a pass on making rude comments about people's appearance because you're gay? I'm just so. Do you see my point?
I do see your point. That's why I'm not so puzzled. I mean, look, it's like when you're no disrespect to anybody's politics, but when you're running on fumes like Mitt Romney is, you know, you try to cut off the dead wood. And he was always a political liability. He says whatever he wants to say, and you can't have a guy like that on your team. You just can't. You know, not if you're running for president. Maybe if you're trying to become, you know, kickball captain, but you can't just
But they hired him.
I know,
he didn't just show up and just refuse to leave. I mean,
well, somebody didn't do the diligence, obviously, because they didn't know this guy was a loose cannon. You don't hire Rodney Dangerfield to do your press, you know, just FYI.
I don't know. Arsalan, you live on Twitter.
Well, you know, the funny thing is that Brian Fisher and other right-wing activists around the country basically, you know, patted themselves on the back for getting Mr. Grenell kicked out. And even though I probably don't agree with any of Mr. Grenell's foreign policy initiatives, I am quite concerned that, you know, you have this sort of knee-jerk pandering to, you know, the right-wing fringe sometimes. And, you know, hopefully we were hoping, you know, now with Mitt Romney as the presumptive Republican nominee, that he would be moving more towards the center to try to appeal to the greatest cross-section of American society.
So sexist tweets okay?
No, I'm not saying that they're okay, but that was not the I mean, this is a guy who's dealing in foreign policy. And if he's going off saying things outside of his portfolio that are going rogue, then I can understand that. But again, you know, these are right-wing activists who are taking credit for the fact that they got a gay man out of the Romney presidential campaign.
So if he made racist tweets, that would be okay, as long as he stuck to his foreign policy portfolio?
No, I mean,
what I said was that he's a loose cannon, period.
Okay.
He's a loose cannon, period, and he shouldn't have ever got the gig.
Listen,
Mario, go ahead.
I mean, there's one, you know, unfortunately, we're entering the new era in which there will be no such thing as private communications for anybody who's facing a potential position in the administration or a campaign like this. I think that the question of his sexual orientation was completely irrelevant to this entire case.
Me too.
Maybe on the fringe, they're making a big deal out of it. But the reason why he had to resign was clearly because of the inappropriateness of the Twitter feed. But this is a person, by the way, and I've had occasion to deal with him when he was a spokesman for the U.S. mission to the United Nations for several years, and I was working on different National Review stories. For example, he was very discreet, very professional, very sophisticated, and certainly not a loose cannon in his professional behavior. That's why John Bolton had confidence in him. That's why the campaign had confidence in him. And, you know, Twitter feeds Twitter. What are we going to do about Twitter?
Do you tweet? Judge, do you tweet?
I do not. My wife does for me. So if you get a tweet from me, it's really for my wife.
Really?
Listen, from my perspective, I think the campaign is entitled to have who they want on the campaign and who they don't want in the campaign, quite frankly, and for whatever reason, as far as I'm concerned. The campaign has one mission, that is to get the nominee elected. What I have a problem with is that there probably wasn't the appropriate vetting done on this individual. If, in fact, this person was, in fact, someone that was a loose cannon, or if, in fact, this person was removed because of the blowback from conservatives, that's something that the campaign should have anticipated, should have vetted out before this person was hired, as far as I'm concerned.
So can we go on record? The judge agreed with me.
I'm going to have to go back over the transcript and make sure.
Brush your shoulder off, brother.
I rule.
Brush your shoulder off.
We need to take a short break, and when we come back, we will have more of The Barbershop with our regular guests, Arsalan Iftikhar, Jimmy Israel, and Mario Loyola, and our special guest, former Attorney General of the United States, Alberto Gonzalez. Please stay with us. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, after 5 years on the air, we decided to ask some of our previous guests in Faith Matters for their reflections on the future. That's in just a few minutes. But first, we continue our Barbershop Roundtable. Our guests are freelance journalist Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, columnist Mario Loyola, and in his first Barbershop appearance, the former Attorney General of the United States, Alberto Gonzalez. I just had one more topic I wanted to run by you, gentlemen. The NFL investigation into that bounty system that where players paid other players for hard hits. It's resulted in the suspension of 4 players. Defensive captain Jonathan Vilma received the stiffest penalty. He's out for an entire year without pay. Now, that can be an eternity in the relatively short career of a professional football player. And I wanted to ask you guys if you think this was the right call. Arsalan, you're the Mads football fan here. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think it was the right call, but I do think that it was disproportionate to the penalties given to the coaches. So Jonathan Vilma, who is alleged to have offered $10,000 for the taking out of Brett Favre or Kurt Warner during playoff games, which is a pretty big deal, suspended for the entire year. As we know, you know, football players have a shorter, you know, career lifespan. So that's essentially 10% of his, you know, professional income. Scott Fujita, who now plays for another team, and 2 others, but Vilma was the strongest one. What's interesting is that, you know, general manager of the New Orleans Saint, Mickey Loomis, and other members of management only got 6 or 8 games. We all know Sean Payton, the head coach, got a 1-year suspension, and Greg Williams, the former defensive coordinator of the Saints, is suspended indefinitely from football. It is a shot across the bow. I think it sends a resounding message to every team around the country that this sort of program, whether or not it's been going on for a long time, will have a zero-tolerance policy moving forward.
Jimmy, what do you think?
I think it's kind of a joke. I think it's going to go on the low. That's why I think it's kind of a joke.
They thought it was going on the low. And
then but they got caught. Yeah. But I don't think this is going to stop it. This is not going to stop the hard hits. This does not stop people putting bounty on other players' heads. I hope that it does, because my son has an interest in football. You know, and I don't want him to think that that's the business. You know, that, oh, snap, Daddy, can I have $5 if I take that kid out? You know, no, I don't want him thinking that's the business. By the same token, I doubt very seriously that this will stop the practice.
Judge, what do you think? You're a football fan, right?
I think we certainly don't want to stop the hard hitting. That is what makes football so attractive to many sports fans around the country. But I think this is going to send a very powerful message. I think it will be a disincentive and for people to engage in this kind of conduct. And I think when the sport is looking at injuries today and possible litigation down the road against the NFL, I think this is a smart business move by the NFL, quite frankly. So I support the decision.
Mario, what do you think? I know you're glad your beloved Green Bay Packers don't seem to have been implicated, but what do you think?
I think when teams lack the finesse of the Green Bay Packers, they have to resort to methods of brute force.
And
so I'm not surprised at what other teams are doing.
Do you think that this is fair? Do you think that the punishment meets the crime, as it were?
I'm sorry, I had to reach for a cliche.
I apologize.
I think that it's very unseemly to have this kind of thing going on. I mean, you know, the NFL should stand for sportsmanlike conduct. And, I mean, hard hitting doesn't mean that you have to violate the sort of basic ethic of sports, which is sportsmanlike conduct.
Judge, I have to ask you, though. The appeals process here is that you appeal to the person who made the decision, which is the commissioner of the NFL. Now, I understand that this is not, you know, but as a former judge yourself, I just have to ask, do you think that's fair? Don't you think there should be some outside entity?
Well, I suppose if I'm a player and I don't think it's fair, I guess I can go to court and seek some kind of relief. We haven't seen that happen. I haven't heard any talk that that's going to happen. But you know, the players know this going in. You know, they know this is the process, and they know what the rules are. They know what the consequences are, and they are suffering the consequences of their decisions.
So don't
see, now the military commissions are starting to look better, aren't they?
Oh, no. You did not go there.
Send everyone there.
Right. Arslan, what about you? I mean, as the civil rights guy here. Right. Well, let's assume that everybody here believes in civil rights, I should say. But as the civil rights lawyer here, do you think that's fair?
I mean, it is due process, you know, within the confines of the NFL legal structure. So Roger Goodell issues a statement and issues a decision, and they want to appeal it. And Roger Goodell says, you know what? I really like my decision, and I'm going to uphold it. And, you know, Sean Payton and Greg Williams, the coaches, appealed also to Roger Goodell, which is the same system. It's not like there's a, you know, two-track system of NFL justice, so to speak. So everybody gets the same fair shake.
So all this legalese just really boils down to don't hate the player, hate the game.
Right.
Okay, good. All right, there we go. Exactly. There we go. Got it.
All right, Jimmy, I'm going to ask you to predict 5 years from now. Are we still going to be talking about this?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, okay. I assure you that we'll still. I mean, it's football. It's not Mahjong. Of course, we're still going to be talking about it. I mean, this is the game is about hard hits. You know, it's about we'd like it to be about sportsmanly conduct.
This isn't about hard hits. But it's about bounties.
And we'd like it to be about sportsmanly conduct. But it just, you know, like I said, this is the real world.
And I think, you know, the talk about hard hits and things like that, I think in 5 years, I think the discussion is going to shift more towards former players and the effects that, you know, a lifelong, you know, Dave Duerson, former, you know, safety of the Chicago Bears, took his own life a few months ago and told his wife to, you know, donate his brain to science to study the impacts of this. Obviously, we're learning about the untimely passing of former San Diego Chargers linebacker Jr. So I think, you know, looking at retired players and seeing what sort of long-term impacts and, you know, sort of mechanisms we have in place for them moving forward, I think is going to be the discussion in 5 years.
We have to leave it there for now.
Okay.
Jimmy Israel is a freelance journalist and presidential fellow at Case Western Reserve University. Arslan Iftikhar is an author, civil rights attorney, and founder of themuslimguide.com. Mario Loyola is director of the Center for 10th Amendment Studies at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. That's a think tank focused on the impact of federal policy on states. He's also a columnist for the National Review. Mario is with us from member station KUT in Austin. Jimmy, Arslan, and Judge Gonzalez were with us in Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, thank you all so much.
Peace.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep.
Now we turn to Faith Matters. That is the part of the program where we talk about matters of faith and spirituality. We're running down the clock on our fifth anniversary celebration. And if you've listened to the program during this last few years, then you know that nearly every Friday, we've turned to people of faith from all traditions, backgrounds, and generations, including those who reject organized religion. And we've asked them to give us their take on the world and issues in the news, and to talk about how faith intersects with so many issues. So on this Friday, as we're wrapping up a week of celebration and reflection on the last 5 years, we asked faith leaders from different traditions who've been guests on the program to offer their blessings for the next 5 years. And we'll start with the one newcomer in the group. He is a young Christian poet. He's making quite a splash on YouTube.
I'm Jefferson Bethke. I'm 22 years old from Tacoma, Washington. And I am a poet, an artist, a writer. And I really enjoy trying to use those mediums to get people to think about Jesus differently. And I had a poem that I came out with in January of 2012 called Why I Hate Religion But Love Jesus that got a lot more views than I thought it would. And so I've tried to steward that platform well and continue to use that to get people to focus on him and not me. So yeah, when you read the scriptures, what you see is something that a lot of times we weren't taught when we were a kid. And what we were taught as a kid is that the Bible or the scriptures is this rule book, this moral code that you need to follow in order to attain good favor with God. But the beautiful part about the scriptures, when you truly understand them, is that Jesus is in every sentence, every object of the scriptures pointing back to himself. So the message that I would probably want to get out there in regards to hope and wisdom and faith that's been given to me that I've noticed is that it's not about us. It's not about our failures. It's not about our successes. It's not about how good enough we are for God. It's not about how bad enough we are for God. But in actuality, it's about what Jesus has done. It's about how good enough he was for God. And when you understand that, when you understand that he's the one that we're supposed to look at, not ourselves, then it stirs something in your heart that draws you outside of yourself into something bigger. And you start to realize what you were created for. And that's an intimate and personal relationship with God through Jesus.
Shalom. My name is Shmuel Hertzfeld, and I'm rabbi of Ohev Shalom, the National Synagogue in Washington, D.C. I'm not only sometimes a guest on Tell Me More, I'm also a huge fan and loyal listener of the show. And since you're also loyal fans of the show, I feel a very special connection with you, and I wanted to offer a blessing to all of us from the perspective of the Jewish tradition. The cardinal statement of Jewish faith is the prayer known as Shema. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. The rabbis understand that the word Shema should be translated as hear, as opposed to listen. Listen might mean that we're passively allowing the sound waves to enter into our ears. But hear means something else. It means that we're accepting that what we have heard, that we're in agreement with what we've heard, that we're committing ourselves with our hearts to do something about what we've heard. That's what we mean when we say, I hear you. So there are so many stories that come to our attention that are of a deep human value and really require us to get involved in the world and make a difference in society. I want to bless our audience that we all go beyond merely being loyal listeners, and instead we become loyal hearers. I close with a prayer from the Talmud. Talmud teaches that words that come from the heart enter into the heart. We all hear words every day. A lot of those words come from the heart. Let's take upon ourselves that it's our job to allow the words that we hear to truly enter into our hearts so that we can help transform the world.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News, and as we wrap up a week of celebrating our fifth anniversary on the air and move into our sixth year, we're listening to faith leaders give their blessings for the future. You just heard Rabbi Shmuel Hertzfeld of Ohev Shalom, the National Synagogue in Washington, D.C., and Christian poet Jefferson Bethke. We now hear from those in the Buddhist, Evangelical, Christian, and Islamic faiths.
I am Amina McLeod, and I am the director of the Islamic World Studies Program and a professor in the Department of Religious Studies at DePaul University here in Chicago. To people who are just coming to know about Islam and its many cultural traditions, in the past 5 years, much of that attention has been negative attention. And I would hope in the next 5 years that Muslims are able to convey the message that in Islam, one central belief is that God made people in tribes so that they could come to know one another and to vie in good deeds. And that in these good deeds, we pay attention to the communities around us and that we resist the temptation to denigrate one another. I think all of our faiths extol the need for us to come together and do the good instead of being comfortable with so much negative rhetoric, and that we take care of some of the social ills we have surrounding us, especially the increasing poverty, the need to care for the elderly and the children.
My name is Reverend Samuel Rodriguez, and I preside over the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference, which is the Hispanic Evangelical Association, approximately 40,100 churches strong, serving this wonderful and booming Hispanic faith demographic within the American religious landscape. I stand convinced that in the midst of a very tiring time, a time in the past few years that has been filled with angst and consternation, flux, and even to a great degree despair, I believe that the best is yet to come. There's hope, and that hope lies embedded in the reality of the cross. Now, that cross is not just vertical or horizontal. It is both vertical and horizontal. Vertically, we stand connected to God, to the kingdom of God, to divine principles, to his glory. Horizontally, we stand connected to each other, to humanity, to our fellow man, to neighborhood and communities and families and relationships. Life is a cross. It is both righteousness vertically and justice on a horizontal plane. It is both sanctification and service, covenant and community, holiness and humility, orthodoxy and orthopraxy. It is both the New Jerusalem and Washington, D.C. It is both the message of salvation and righteousness of Dr. Billy Graham and the prophetic activism of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. What if, in America, we can finally reconcile the message of Billy Graham with the message of Martin Luther King Jr.? Then we will see faith that reconciles and does not pull apart, a faith that goes way beyond the agendas of the donkey or the elephant, but really enunciates the agenda of the lamb, where our moniker is do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly before God. So I pray that the strength of the Father and that the grace of the Son, that the anointing of God's Holy Spirit will empower and enable us to live life both vertically and horizontally in his name.
Hello, congratulations on your anniversary and best wishes for the upcoming year. My name is Tenzin Lamo. I'm a Tibetan Buddhist nun ordained in India by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. A strange turn of events for someone born in an Irish Catholic family in Pennsylvania. By the time I was 20, I had realized that that Catholic faith wasn't the right one for me, though it is for many. I didn't realize, though, that I would go 25 years looking for another faith to believe in. During those years of raising three great kids and having a life of privilege, I still knew there was a rich dimension missing in my life. And this realization strengthened as I went through a divorce and then the loss of my mother and father and sister and family members in quick succession. All of this has created in me the wish for you today, as expressed in a verse of the Buddha who walked around India teaching 2,600 years ago. He said, "Praise and blame, gain and loss, pleasure and sorrow, these come and go like the wind. To be happy, rest like a great tree amidst them all." So what allows that great tree to rest? In my mind, it's a strong, clear, profound sense of faith in something. That's what I wish you. Whether your faith is secular, in morality or in a good cause such as helping needy children or injured animals or the earth, or whether it's religious, may your faith be strong and allow you transcendence over any of the difficulties of your life so that you can live, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, with courage, compassion, and awareness. This is my heartfelt wish for you. Thank you.
We just heard from Tibetan Buddhist nun Tenzin Lamo, the Reverend Samuel Rodriguez. He is an evangelical Christian minister, Islamic scholar Amina McLeod, Rabbi Shmuel Hertzfeld of Ohev Shalom, the National Synagogue, that's an Orthodox synagogue in Washington, D.C., and Christian poet Jefferson Bethke. And we'd like to thank all of our faith leaders for their blessings. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we wrap up our week-long celebration of our fifth anniversary on the air with a final conversation about what's fun about being five. That's just ahead. But first, we want to tell you about a very funny and poignant film about people at the other end of lifespan, retirement. Now, retirement has generally not been the most amusing subject, especially in recent years when many seniors in the U.S. and in countries around the world have seen their savings vanish for various reasons. What to do when they still have many years ahead? The movie, The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, which opens in select cities today, follows a group of British senior citizens who travel to India, hoping to spend their retirement years in an inexpensive but luxurious hotel, only to find that their new home is not exactly the palace they envisioned. Once they arrive, they are welcomed by Sunny, the young hotel manager, played by Dev Patel, who previously starred in the Oscar-winning film Slumdog Millionaire.
Gentle friends, you have found your way to this place bequeathed to me by my beloved father, that I have raised from the ruins of his broken dreams and renamed the Best Exotic Marigold Hotel for the elderly and beautiful. Who knows how many days you have left? But we are most honored that you have chosen to spend that time with us.
And actor Dev Patel joins us now. Not the most delicate welcome, but...
I know. Rather aggressive.
But
it's
charming.
So weird when you hear your performance and, you know, the visuals are stripped away and you just hear your voice and the sound. It's crazy.
So let's talk about the film. First of all, what drew you to this?
You know, after Slumdog, I get sent so many scripts that are, you know, Indian-centric. And, you know, I try to be selective to avoid being typecast, number one. But number two, because I want to tell the right stories. And, you know, India is just a wealth of amazing stories. And I found that out when I was there. And I was utterly inspired. That's the first reason. The second reason is we have probably one of the most phenomenal casts. You know, for a young actor like me to be able to work with the likes of, you know, Dame Judi Dench, Dame Maggie Smith, Bill Nighy, Tom Wilkinson, all these theatre greats like Ronnie Pickup, Penelope Wilton. And it was a real honour and a pleasure. And the director, John Madden, who's directed Shakespeare in Love, was also just a dream to work with. And, you know, it was a chance to go back to a place that I really, you know, fell in love with during Slumdog and, you know, film again, I guess.
Well, it is India-centric, though. And
yeah.
And I think for people who don't know, you didn't grow up in India. You grew up in England.
No, I'm from the UK. Yeah, yeah. That's the accent.
Yeah. So really that was my question. Were you at all concerned about being typecast? Because it is another India-centric
project. Yeah, and
project.
He's definitely a loud one. Not really, because, you know, I, more than anything, this is, I think, a real poignant comedy. And most of my decisions are based on gut instinct. You know, I can read half a script and I decide before I've even finished if I'm going to do it or not. And with this one, I definitely knew, without even knowing the amazing cast that was attached, which speaks volumes in itself. But I was like, you know, this is something that I really... It's a character that I can get my teeth into. He's this kind of flamboyant entrepreneur who has this, you know, dream to outsource old age.
Well, he so means well. He is so... dare I say it, adorable. I hope you don't mind.
No, but, I was aiming for that. Annoyingly adorable is what I was aiming for.
Well, tell me more. That was my question, is what were you thinking about when putting this character together? Sunny is, as you can hear from that, just that short clip that you played, he's frantic. He's trying to get the hotel ready. And he doesn't even seem to really realize that he has kind of oversold the thing.
Yes. You know? Yeah. Well, he, you know, he's this kind of mad mess, you know, who is untamed. And for someone like me reading it, I knew I could really have some fun. And, you know, he's ever the optimist. His line he always uses, his go-to line is, everything will be all right in the end. And if it's not all right, then it's not yet the end. And, you know, he kind of uses it in moments as an excuse. You know, when the guests arrive, for instance, he's still trying to paint the building and he's got green paint all over his face when they all arrive. they soon find out that this hotel that they saw in the brochure has actually just been magnificently photoshopped by this kid. And it's just a nightmare, you know, when you get there.
Well, and it's not his only challenge in the film.
Yeah.
He also, and I must say,
there's a little bit of romance.
Not only in a little bit, this is just the second film in which you have like a fabulous love interest. I don't know who
it's
you
in
must
the contract.
Have.
No, I'm
oh,
joking.
Is it? Okay.
No,
I was going to say, you. I don't know whether you've. That the casting gods have been looking out for
I
you.
I do not do a movie unless the woman is stupidly out of my league. My co-star. No, I'm joking. Okay.
So the theme here is he's trying to get his very traditional mother to warm up to his girlfriend, Sunaina,
yeah.
who's played by Tina Desai.
Yes.
And let's play a short clip for about a scene between the two of them here.
Oh, God. Here we go.
Do you love me, Sunny?
My feelings for you cannot be reduced to a single word.
It's a nice word. People like hearing it.
You know, it will be easier to talk to my mother when the hotel is a success.
And what if it isn't?
Everything will be all right in the end. And if it is not all right, then it is not yet the end.
Sunny.
It will succeed. It has to.
Because then you can stand up to your family.
Because then I can stand next to you.
All together now. Aww.
That's going to spoil my street cred, that one. Damn.
No. If it hasn't been already. Well, sorry. But... You know, but let me just talk about this. The scenario there is not unique to India, okay, in the sense of a young person is drawn to someone who his parents do not approve of for whatever reason. I mean, that seems to be kind of a universal theme. But it is interesting sort of in the context of, I think, you know, modern India, where there does seem to be this pull between tradition and, modernity. You just talk a little bit about how you saw that relationship.
Well, it's great because in Slumdog, I'm obviously playing a character that's on a whole different spectrum of society. Sunny, the character I play in this show, in this movie, he comes from wealth and he has this background of these brothers who are all doing fantastically well and, you know, doing his parents proud. And he's this one boy who is kind of gone askew, you know, and straight. And, you know, he falls in love with this girl who's kind of wild one. And his mother is... completely disapproving, and he's really not manned up to the situation and actually introduced them properly. And they meet, I don't want to give too much away, but they meet in the worst scenario possible for your mother to kind of find your girlfriend and be introduced, and everything just goes wrong from there.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News, and I'm speaking with actor Dev Patel. You know him from Slumdog Millionaire fame. We're talking about his new movie, The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. It opens today in select U.S. theaters. You mentioned earlier that this was a great opportunity for you to work with, in this country, known primarily as Oscar winners, Judi Dench and Maggie Smith, Oscar nominee Tom Wilkinson. What was that like, working with them? Was it intimidating?
Auditioning was great. And then as soon as I got the call saying that I'd been awarded this role, the nerves immediately kicked in. And, you know, the week before I flew out to India to meet everyone and shoot and rehearse, it literally was the most terrifying moment of my entire life because, you know, they've been acting since I was a fetus. I don't know. I mean, they've just been around for so long and they've seen it all. And I'm like, what have I got to offer? And all these kind of, you know, things run through your brain. But as soon as I flew out and met them all in India, it, you know, I've never, and this is going to sound so cliche and tacky, but literally they're the coolest bunch of people I've ever met. It was good fun.
Well, congratulations on everything that you've achieved so far. I did want to ask before we let you go, you know, both of your previous films, Slumdog Millionaire and The Last Airbender, kind of sparked conversations apart from the films. In Slumdog, as I'm sure you know, there was all kinds of conversation about filmmaker Danny Boyle, whether he had done enough to kind of give back in the wake of the success of the film. And then in The Last Airbender, that was criticized by a lot of fans of the original animated series Avatar, because the characters in that original story were Asian, and the only Asian actor cast in a major role was you. Then you played a villain. And I'm just wondering your thoughts on both of those controversies.
On both of those. To start off with Slumdog, it was an incredibly tricky situation because, you know, we had this filmmaker who wanted to make a kind of movie that would open eyes around the world, and he wanted it to be as authentic as possible. I think the important thing that a lot of people need to understand is, you know, when you grow up in a place like a slum in Mumbai, the essential thing to give these children is actually the gift of education. So we'd set up this kind of thing where Danny had and a few of the people on the film set had kind of taken it on their hands to find an English-speaking school to put these children into. And the idea was they could only access their fund when they were 18 and they'd stayed in the school to be educated. And obviously, when you're doing a movie that's so big, there's this massive magnification lens put on it and everyone's trying to find a kind of chink in the armor, I guess, mm-hmm. of this kind of big movie, you know, mm-hmm. Which is sad because, you know, in this case, they went to crazy extents, you know, to kind of do this.
What about The Last Airbender?
Oh, The Last Airbender. I was a massive fan of this cartoon and I signed on to do this movie and I've been doing martial arts for 8 years. A little note for you there. You know, it made me realize when you're doing these big films, you become really small in the process of this, you know, this big mechanical machine, this studio movie. My character, the so-called villain in the first episode, goes on to be the kind of hero of the show, and he's kind of the fan favorite. So for me, it actually was the coolest role to play, you know, this kind of kid who could throw fire out of his hands and things.
Well, who doesn't want to throw fire?
Exactly. It's every like, I was like, I don't know how old I was 18. I was like, every 18-year-old's dream to play a role like that.
Well, what do you hope people will get out of the Best Exotic Marigold Hotel?
I think it's a story about living life at any age. You know, it's a group of retirees that get thrown into one of the most extreme environments in the world. And, you know, some of them are done with learning and experiencing and they put up these bars and they're kind of swallowed alive by this crazy environment, which is India. And the others kind of are open and willing to experience. And it's a really great story about cherishing life and seeing that, you know, it's worth living at any age, you know.
Well, congratulations to you on all your success. Come back and see us.
I will do.
Dev Patel is an actor. His latest film is The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. It opens in select U.S. theaters today. And we caught up with him at our NPR West studios in Culver City, California. Dev Patel, thank you so much for speaking with us.
That's cool. It's a pleasure.
So, we might have mentioned one or two or maybe even three times that this program turned five this week, but we can't help it. Turning five is a big deal. The program launched on April 30th, 2007, and not to put too fine a point on it, it was a tough environment for both print and broadcast. So, yes, we've been celebrating our birthday all this week. And unfortunately, like all good things, the on-air party is coming to an end, at least until we celebrate our sixth birthday next year. But this week, we decided to hear from five-year-olds across the country about what is so fantastic about being five. And so now, as a grand finale to our fifth anniversary week, we decided to visit in studio with some of our young listeners. Here with me, Brooke Chapman, Trip Perkins, Gabriella Young, and Anna Millicent. And Brooke, let me start with you. What do you like about being five?
I'm a drummer.
How long have you been drumming?
About five.
You've been drumming since you were zero?
No, I drum 1 million days.
Awesome. Anna, what do you like about being five?
Cartwheels. My sister can do a cartwheel, and I can do a split.
Awesome. Trip, what do you like about being five?
Skateboarding.
Oh, Perkins Trip. It's Perkins Trip.
Do you learn any special songs when you're five?
Yep.
What songs do you learn, Gabby?
Well, I forgot some songs.
But does anybody know the birthday song? Anna 1, Anna 2, Anna 3. Can you do that? Can you start?
Anna 1, Anna 2, Anna 3, Anna 4. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear.
Tell me more.
Tripper. No!
Brooke.
Brooke.
Gabby.
Happy birthday
Anna.
To you.
Yay!
Yay!
Yay! Okay. You're only five for a small amount of time. What can you do when you're five that you couldn't do when you were four? Go ahead, Gabby.
I have a wiggly tooth, and also my sister teaches me how to do things. And also, one more thing. I could clean my room better than my sister that's about to be eight.
You can clean your room better than your sister who's about to be eight?
Mm-hmm.
Is anybody going to kindergarten next year?
I am.
Yay.
I am.
You are too? Okay, then let's start with Gabby. Yeah. What are you looking forward to in kindergarten?
Writing.
Writing in kindergarten. Excellent. Trip, what are you looking forward to in kindergarten?
playing.
Brooke, what are you looking forward to?
I want to be a rock star on skateboard.
Really? Yeah. I'm shocked by this. Okay, before we let you go, you wanted to beatbox our theme song. Neil's going to play it for you for a little bit, and then you're going to beatbox it, okay? There it is. Listen.
Yeah, yeah, hippie, yeah. Everybody, yeah, yeah. Everybody, rock to stay. Everybody, rock to stay. Back on!
Yay! That's good. Okay. We've been speaking with some of our youngest fans, Brooke Chapman, Tripp Perkins, Gabby Young, and Anna Milicic, here in our Washington, D.C. studios. It's been so much fun talking to all of you. Thank you for celebrating our fifth birthday with us. But for a special preview of what it's like to be six, now we have with us Ava Milicic. Ava, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
What's fun about being six so we have something to look forward to?
I think it's fun to go on the bus to elementary school.
And is there something you can do that you're six that you couldn't do when you were five?
I couldn't ride a scooter when I was five.
And now you can?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
That is Ava Milicic with a preview of what it's like to be six. And that's our program for today. And as a final word, we normally take time for credits once a week when we recognize the work of the Tell Me More staff. But on this week, when we've been celebrating our fifth anniversary on the air, we decided that there are so many people who helped make this program possible that we wanted to recognize them. And today we want to thank all of our member stations and listeners. In other words, you, because you are the reason we are here. You make our work possible, and we appreciate it. So thank you. And remember, you can always tell us more by going to npr.org and finding us under the Programs tab. You can also find our podcast there. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Tell Me More NPR. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more on Monday.